Hi everyone, this is Rav Yossi Golden. Here is this week's parenting from the Parsha, Parshat Vayetze, entitled Seeing Their Perspective. In Sefer Yirmiyahu, chapter 31, Yirmiyahu details the scene in heaven as Am Yisrael leave Eretz Yisrael following the second Beit HaMikdash's destruction. The well-known psukim describe Rachel Imenu crying for her children and refusing consolation over their descent into exile. The Navi then describes how God ultimately responds with one of the most powerful and poignant promises in all of Tanakh. Quote, "Thus says God, hold back your voice from crying and dry your eyes from tears, for there is reward for your action. Your children will return from the land of the enemy. There is hope for you in the end. Your children will return to their rightful borders." End quote. The question that arises is, why were Rachel's tefillot answered so positively? What was so compelling about her tefillot? This question is compounded by the expansion of the Midrash Eicha on this heavenly scene following the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. The Midrash adds that each of the Avot, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, as well as Moshe Rabbeinu, each approach Hashem individually, arguing for the Jewish people to be saved and for exile to be avoided. Yet God rejects each of their arguments. It is only Rachel Imenu who makes her passionate plea that God responds by promising the eventual return of the Jewish people to their homeland. Once again, what aspects of Rachel's argument was so convincing that it was heard by Hashem, while the Avot and Moshe Rabbeinu were not? Part of God's response to Rachel is that, quote, "there is reward for your action," end quote, implying that it wasn't simply Rachel's tefillot, but rather something she did that caused God to respond positively to her plea. What exactly did Rachel do that was so uniquely commendable? The standard explanation, and one that is highlighted by the aforementioned Midrash Eicha, is that it was Rachel's selfless act on behalf of her sister Leah that led to such incredible reward. Rachel waited 7 years to marry Yaakov, only to have those plans foiled by her father Lavan. However, rather than allow her sister to be embarrassed under the chuppah, Rachel passed along to Leah the secret signs that she and Yaakov had established as evidence of Rachel's identity. This incredible act of selflessness was so unique and extraordinary that Hashem was forced to respond to her pleas hundreds of years later. However, Rabbi David Foreman suggests a new perspective to this entire episode. He notes that if we look closely at the psukim in Yirmiyahu, there is a hint to the special act that Rachel had performed. God says to Rachel, quote, "Yesh sachar lipulotech," there is reward to your actions, end quote. And the words yesh sachar, if put together, actually spell the name of Leah's fifth son, Yisachar. This implies, suggests Rabbi Foreman, that Rachel's true act of heroism somehow revolved around the birth of Yisachar. The birth of Yisachar occurs in this week's Parsha, and the events surrounding his birth are entirely enigmatic. The Torah recounts how Reuven, Leah's firstborn, finds dudaim plants, which he gives to his mother. When Rachel approaches Leah and asks for some of these dudaim, Leah responds, quote, "Isn't it enough that you have taken my husband? Now you want to take my dudaim as well?" End quote. Upon hearing this, Rachel offers to Leah, quote, "You can have the opportunity to sleep with Yaakov tonight in exchange for the dudaim." End quote. Leah agrees, and Yisachar is conceived that evening. Much of this episode is hard to understand. What are the dudaim, and what is their significance? How are we to understand the ongoing interchange between Rachel and Leah? Reformers suggest that powerful ideas course beneath the surface of this episode as Rachel and Leah finally come to a head regarding their complex relationship. We first need to understand Rachel's perspective. She waited 7 long years to marry the man she loved, only to have her father push her aside and send her sister to the chuppah in her place. She finally marries Yaakov as well. However, Leah quickly gives birth to a number of children to Yaakov, while Rachel remains barren. One could imagine the tremendous pain Rachel must be feeling. First, her sister steals her husband, and then she overshadows her by giving birth to all these children while she herself remains unable to conceive. Leah's oldest, Reuven, approaches Leah with a gift of flowers, dudaim, that he found in the wild, perhaps meant to be a symbol of his love for his mother. Upon seeing that, Rachel asks Leah if perhaps she could also have a few of the flowers, possibly in order to also share in the symbolic love of a child that she herself is not merited to have. Yet Leah's response is quite startling. She says, quote, "Isn't it enough that you took my husband? Now you also want to take the dudaim of my child?" End quote. At first glance, Leah's words seem out of place. In what way did Rachel take her husband? If anything, it was Leah who married the man that Rachel was meant to marry. And yet, Leah's words cause Rachel to reconsider this entire narrative and to see things from Leah's perspective. From Leah's standpoint, she was forced by her father into a marriage she hadn't asked for, ended up marrying a man who really wanted to marry her sister. Her sister then willingly married the same man, effectively causing a rupture in her relationship with her husband, as Yaakov naturally favored Rachel over Leah, even though Leah bore him 4 sons while Rachel was barren. Leah feels unloved and unappreciated. One day, her oldest son gives her a gift, and Rachel has the gall to ask for a portion of that gift? At that moment, Rachel was finally able to see things from Leah's perspective. Her response? To give Leah the one thing she desired more than anything else, a real relationship with her husband. She offers for Leah to spend the night with Yaakov. As opposed to Leah's wedding night, where Rachel was forced to allow Leah to be with Yaakov, here, Rachel willingly offers Leah the opportunity to be with Yaakov, resulting in the birth of Yisachar. We can now understand the enormous power of Rachel's action on that night. In an instant, she was able to appreciate Leah's perspective, to step away from her own pain and anguish, and see things from the other side. Rachel recognized that at all moments of conflict, there are two sides to a story, and that the key to resolving such conflict rises out of a concerted effort to see things from the other person's perspective. It was that heroic effort that came to define Rachel and ultimately forced God to respond to Rachel's pleas with a promise of the future redemption. It is extremely difficult to truly understand the perspective of others. So biased are we to our own inner worlds and to our perception of events and experiences around us that we tend to see our outlook as factually correct. Yet we must strive to understand the perspective of others, particularly in the realm of parenting. As parents, we encounter our kids at all ages as they go through the various stages of childhood and adolescence and young adulthood. At each of these stages, our children experience the world from a certain standpoint, cognitively and emotionally. Parents, because we are older and feel wiser, can sometimes be dismissive of their child's perspective, failing to understand it and not having much patience for it. Yet our dismissiveness of our child's standpoint can have a negative effect on that child and on our relationship with him. To give a few examples. Number one, a young toddler builds a palace of pillows and blankets in the playroom, declaring himself king of the castle. A few minutes later, another sibling walks by and, either by mistake or otherwise, knocks the castle down. The toddler is devastated that his castle has been destroyed. Our initial reaction may be to say, "What's the big deal? It wasn't a real castle anyway." Yet to this child, at his emotional and cognitive stage, it was as real a castle as can be. And when we belittle that reality for him, he feels unheard. Number two, a teenage child undergoes a medical procedure that alters their physical appearance. They are devastated how they look and refuse to go to school or visit with friends. Our initial reaction may be to say, "What's the big deal? No one's really looking at you. You look fine. It'll go away soon anyway." But such a response reflects a failure to appreciate and understand the role that physical appearance and social status play in the lives of adolescents from the cognitive and emotional standpoint. If we are dismissive of their feelings and fail to see their perspective, then our children will get the impression that we don't understand them and may stop sharing with us. Example number three. Those of us who grew up without cell phones as a child, and certainly without smartphones, may tend to be extremely critical of the way that our children communicate and interact with their friends socially. Yet what we fail to appreciate is that our children are growing up in a drastically different environment than the one we grew up in. Our children are exposed to phones and technology at a much earlier age than we were, and is much more a part of their childhood than ours. This reality causes our children to relate to technology and use it in a very different way than we did. To be clear, understanding the perspective of others does not necessarily mean that we need to give in to them or completely dismiss our own point of view. What it does mean is that we should consider how we react to certain conflicts or events in the lives of our children, that we should take a moment to consider things from their perspective, and only then to decide upon the proper course of action, taking their standpoint into account. Doing so will make us more empathetic parents and ultimately more effective parents as well. Thank you all for listening and wishing everyone a Shabbat Shalom.